This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Way back in the foggy mists of computing time, let's call it May of 1992, we had a conversation on this program that's listed in our office archives as What is the Future of Personal Computing? Guests on that hour were Robert X. Cringely, then a gossip columnist for InfoWorld, and Esther Dyson, then creator and author of the monthly technology industry newsletter Release 1.0. I asked them to help us understand the world of personal computing, PCs, and to predict what was still to come. That was a big task considering that the World Wide Web was still in its infancy, the Mosaic web browser wouldn't be released until 1993, and when it comes to smartphones, well, this was about a year before the first phone-to-phone SMS message. So we're talking dinosaur age. Wouldn't it be fun now to see how well their predictions panned out? Well, joining me now here in our studio is Esther Dyson, whose tech role has morphed from newsletter publisher to advisor to tech entrepreneur and investor. She's chairman of Edventure Holdings. Good to talk with you again so many years later.
Yeah, it's great. I'm a little scared to hear what it is, what stupid things I said way back then.
Well, let's just talk about in general. How would you say personal computing has changed since 1992 in general?
Well, the biggest thing is everything is connected. The notion of an unconnected computer, just like, well, what would you do with it? How would you get data in and out?
And the original PC didn't even have an internet card on. It didn't have a networking card on.
Well, there was no internet.
There was no internet. Let's turn back the clock to yesteryear. I'm going to ask you to listen to this tape way back when.
Are we ever going to get to the day when a computer will be as simple to turn it on and run it as an electric typewriter? Let me ask you, Mr. Dyson, first.
Well, in some sense you are, because you're going to have lots of computers all over the place doing individual things. You'll have them in your walls. You'll have them in your microwave oven, you'll have little pen computers you take with you. But on the other hand, the stuff that's really neat and leading edge will still be leading edge, and it will probably still be crashing 20 years from now. It's just what it's going to be doing is going to be 20 times better.
Wow, you hit that one right out of the park.
Yeah, that one's pretty good.
You predicted that computers would be in everything, which they are in now, right? What made you think that would be true?
Well, I don't remember, but it seemed pretty clear you would want them everywhere and that they were getting smaller. You could... A lot of things were really clear. The internet wasn't a big thing, but, yeah, we were already on email. I was involved with the Electronic Frontier Foundation at that point. I'd started using email pretty much in 1989, mostly to get in touch with people in Russia because you couldn't phone them.
We asked both of you about what your ideal computer would be.
What would be the ideal personal computer for you, Robert Cringely?
Well, I'm the sort of guy who would like to go out my door and whistle for my car. So I think the ideal personal computer for me would be a being that I spoke to, that spoke back, that was kindly and did whatever I asked. And that's where we're headed.
You mean a voice-actuated sort of thing?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So you could sit down at your PC and just speak a letter or tell it to turn your roast on in the oven or something.
And have it understand what I mean and what my mood is.
And you, Esther Dyson?
Well, what he's really saying, and he's right, is what you want is a secretary that doesn't have feelings, that can be hurt, and that doesn't get sick. You want an intelligent thing, and I believe, contrary to, for example, Apple's Knowledge Navigator, you do not want something that pretends to be human, because that's either insulting or scary. But you want something that understands you, that's intelligent and intelligible, but not a mock-up human.
Is that Siri, what you're talking about?
I think we both hit it.
Yeah. I mean, there's something that was called, we call today, the uncanny valley. Are you familiar with that term? It's where computers are almost humanoid, so they're really spooky. And that seems to be what you were talking about in those days.
Yeah, I don't want my refrigerator to have feelings. I just want it to keep the right food there or whatever.
Did you ever think that we might see self-driving cars?
Yes.
You did.
One reason is I do not drive. And I did know about autonomous vehicles and stuff like that. So for me, that's always been something I was looking forward to.
Oh. One of the things that stands out in the tape from this program in 1992 is that it is more or less pre-web. There was no internet there. And here's the closest thing that got to the idea of e-commerce back then.
Okay.
There's going to be people doing incredibly wonderful stuff in communications. There's a lot of software involved, again, in mediating the flow of information, where you automate filtering, you automate something like the Sabre airline system, where people get information from different airlines to plan trips. Imagine something similar that would let you get information on, for example, computer parts to assemble a large computer system.
Boy, you hit that out of the park again.
It was obvious, but yeah, nice.
I mean, we could never imagine using computers to do buying tickets, so, you know, airlines, reservations or whatever, but that, to you, was the future. And Sabre was what, American Airlines, that they owned
Sabre?
Yeah,
Max Hopper.
And how did that evolve into, you know, what it is today?
Well, I mean, ultimately, you got, Sabre was beyond just American Airlines. You got all these airlines, and now you have Kayak as a front end. I mean, the big thing was when you had I'm not sure Kayak was the first one, but when you could actually go online and get information from multiple airlines.
Right.
This is what your travel agent did.
Right.
And now an individual could do that.
That was amazing that you could actually be your own travel agent. And you foresaw that back almost 25 years ago, 23 years ago. Even back then, there was the idea that the computer was not an end in itself, but the connections it had.
Yeah.
Robert Cringely, where is the hot new ground being broken in PCs these days?
Well, we're actually at an important transition point. The processing power is about to just take off like crazy. The microprocessors are becoming increasingly more powerful. Unfortunately, the software hasn't quite caught up with that yet. And as these two parts of the business come into sync, and most importantly, as entrepreneurs find ways of making money with it, then we'll see things happen. Probably by the end of this decade, the computing world will be dramatically different than it is today, and it will be run by completely different players.
Esther Dyson?
Areas that are really nifty right now are, number one, pen computing and other kinds of input like voice recognition. Another really neat area is dealing not with data and numbers, but with text. So the whole notion of email communications, instead of using your computer to calculate and having the person talk to his personal computer, what's interesting now is using your computer as a communication device, helping you to communicate with other people. And in that sense, it can be your agent helping you set up appointments, going out and looking for information for you or whatever. But it's the unconnected computer is going to be about as useful as the unconnected telephone.
Wow. Yeah, I almost said that earlier on the show, but it just seems
well,
so
did we
trite.
Know that, did we know that the telephone would become
totally connected? Yeah.
Your computer.
Yeah.
What about your future? Were you able to predict where you are today? Tell us about what you're working on today.
The interesting problems now are not in computing. The interesting problems are in human nature. And, you know, on the one hand, there's global warming, which I know you're doing a lot about. And on the other hand, there's global sickening. So global warming is the result of we have too many wonderful machines and factories, and we can make all these wonderful things, but they produce noxious gases and they're harming the environment. In the same way, we can create wonderful, delicious foods and alcohol and drugs for ourselves. We can live lives of luxury and not have to run around. We can sit on our butts all day and play with computers and do virtual reality. And just as the industrial stuff is harming the environment, this other stuff is harming our bodies. And so we need a good environment, but we also need healthy bodies to take advantage of that. And that is a huge problem, which revolves around how we deal with our own predilections for stuff that's bad for us.
So how are you involved in that?
So I'm running a project called The Way to Wellville in five small communities around the United States. And it's very not scientific or techie. It's not about wearables. It's about doing what we know we need to do to create health, which is prenatal care, healthy food, talking to children, preschool education, sort of going in right at the beginning, where if the parents aren't good enough parents, helping to turn them into better parents, and then producing children who are healthy. And doing that in small places where you can do it without too much resource, as an example to, this is what we should be doing everywhere, people. And it's collective action in these small places. It may require government interference, a la taxing sugar, just the way we should be taxing carbon, to deal with the externalities cost.
It's interesting that you're doing this about World Health. Another computer giant, Bill Gates, is involved in World Health.
Yeah, I'm actually involved in local health, mm-hmm. because that's where you produce health. You produce it locally in a community where kids can run outside and eat healthy food and their parents are talking to them. And it needs to start locally and spread worldwide.
Are you teaching communities how to be healthier, or you don't want to use that word?
No.
Because you're like an outsider coming in.
Yeah, we're not teaching them. It's not a nice white lady from New York telling people how to live. It's more helping them understand how to be accountable. In other words, it's not good enough to run a program. Mm-hmm. You have to actually have a system that's accountable for reducing obesity by making sure there's healthy food, by negotiating with the local vendors, by starting exercise classes for kids. Again, really having effective early childhood education so that all the children get talked to and learn how to read. So you don't need to be lucky to be normal. That's what's happened in the middle of America. It's normal to be unlucky because something goes wrong, then something else goes wrong, and you can't climb out.
Right. You had no choice in the matter. What's the name of the organization again?
The Way to Wellville. The website is actually hiccup.co, HICCUP.co. Stood for Health Initiative Coordinating Council.
Well, that's good.
Well, it was our original name, but my CEO, who's Prince, said, you know, that's clever, but I'm not sure people will understand it. And the Way to Wellville, mm-hmm. and on Twitter, at The Way to Wellville is where you can find us.
We're going to take a short break, come back and talk about what we thought computers would be and what computers actually turned out to be with Esther Dyson, who's an original geek from way back. I guess it's the same way I am. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. This is Science Friday from PRI. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about personal computing and the tech industry. We're looking back on some of the thoughts of the industry. Well, a program we did way back in 1992, and on that program was my guest Esther Dyson. Lots of gold in those old those old comments. Let's listen to another one. One question we asked was, do I need a PC? And here's what computer columnist Robert X. Cringely had to say.
When somebody says to you, do I need a PC, how do you tell somebody whether they need one or not?
How do I?
Yeah.
Well, I ask what they expect it to do for them. And for the most part, if it turns out that they're doing word processing and doing a few envelopes, sometimes a typewriter is a much better choice.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's my rule that if you have to ask, you really don't need one.
Good point.
Esther, do you have any set answers to that?
Well, my first reaction to the problem is two. One is give the industry time. Mm-hmm. Of course, this stuff is awful to use, and I'm frustrated every day because I know that 10 years from now, I won't be wasting my time doing a lot of these stupid little things that ought to be automatic. But the second is, I don't know how to drive a car. Mm-hmm. And so to me, things like carburetor and, I don't know, drop shift or gear, whatever.
Whatever.
That stuff is jargon. Whereas anybody who drives a car will say, what do you mean jargon? That's intuitive.
Yeah.
And so in some sense, kids will grow up and they won't think of it as jargon. They'll think of it as normal
new
words.
New generation.
And so, again, give it time.
Yeah, but you know, it's tough to tell somebody to work a PC if they can't program their VCR yet.
VCRs are a whole other problem. Those are impossible.
If you still have one, they're still impossible to program. But do you still believe, I mean, about giving it time? Just give it time.
Yeah, but give it time for yet another iteration. I mean, now I still waste a lot of time with this thing, and it does amazingly much better things than it used to. But I waste time clicking on something and then waiting for an interaction. I waste time downloading stuff. It's still, all these things have different kinds of plugs.
Right.
We need wireless charging. So, yeah, it keeps getting better. And it's clear that, as I said, 23 years ago, 10 years from now, we'll still be complaining. We'll just be complaining about different problems.
Right. But and what you also talked about and in that statement back then was we're kids. Give kids time and they'll adapt to it. And they have taken to it like they were born with it. They have been born with it, right? Are you surprised at how easily they take to this?
No. I mean, people think whatever they grew up with is normal. And you see that again and again, whether it's they come from a different country or they come from a different technology area. You think that what is normal to you is intuitive to anyone. And mm-hmm. you know, now at least most people have more experience of more parts of the world, so they're a little more sophisticated. But what seems normal to the kids of today, the new stuff will still seem abnormal to them 20 years from now, and the kids who are minus 20 years now will think it's normal.
Do you feel, looking back now, that it's easier for you to make predictions about the future? Because we've been playing cuts here, tape from you 23 years ago, that you were right on these things.
Well, it's really not predicting the future. It's saying what the dynamics are, what should happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always resisted this futurist notion. It's simply, if you understand the present well enough, you have a pretty good sense of what these things are capable of.
Right. 1992 was during the period that Steve Jobs was not at Apple, but he was working on Next.
Is there anybody who can take on Apple and IBM? Is that it for the foreseeable future?
Oh, of course there are.
What happened to the Next computer?
Well, that's an interesting question. What did happen to the Next computer? Next is Steve Jobs, who was the founder of Apple Computer, was thrown out of the company in 1985 and went off to start a venture of retribution called Next Incorporated, which was intended to do his computer, a sort of Unix workstation for the masses. And he introduced some very novel software that is it's very much like the stuff the fellow from Apple described, the pink stuff. I mean, it's object-oriented, it's very aggressive. Unfortunately, he wrapped it around some relatively not leading-edge hardware, which didn't make it run very fast in comparison to some of the other stuff out there.
Mm-hmm.
So Next has been struggling, but they're coming out with their third-generation product shortly, and they have hopes for the future. And if anyone can do it, I suppose Steve Jobs can do it.
That, of course, was computer columnist Robert X. Cringely, who, along with Esther Dyson, was on our show in 1992. Do you remember that, Esther?
I do, indeed.
Tell us what you remember about that.
Well, it was sort of too sciencey and never really caught on. And what really did, people wanted things that were simpler, not things that were more grandiose.
Mm-hmm. Didn't he bring Next back to Apple? He returned to Apple, right?
Yeah.
And he brought that idea back with him.
He just came back and realized what people wanted was simplicity and ease of use. And I'm sure he learned a lot at Next, including how to deal with people.
How was Steve looked at in those days?
Steve was always magnetic and something of a jerk. And so people in the industry, people didn't really like him much.
Mm-hmm.
They were competing with him. He was a really tough competitor. But this particular, he came out and spoke at PC Forum, my conference, and then he had to leave to go be on Larry King. So a whole bunch of us gathered in somebody's hotel room to watch him on Larry King, and suddenly it changed from Steve, he's a jerk, to he's telling the rest of America about our business and our products and how everybody's going to love their computer. And he was the guy who was best able to tell the broad public about us, because most of us were terrible at talking to normal people, and he was magnetic. So there was that kind of jealousy, admiration, frustration. But he was, most of the other people in the industry, they occupied a place that had they not been there, someone else would have occupied it. You know, this operating system, the big email system, what have you. Steve actually did something that no one else would have done. His was genuinely a personal company. Without his vision, you would not have had something akin to Apple. You might have had a more user-centric or something, but he was unique in that way. It was his personal vision rather than a marketplace position.
Mm-hmm. So while his personality might have grated on you a little bit.
Me and many other people.
You were happy he was there.
Yeah. And, I mean, he was charming and magnetic. I went, the next was announced at Moscone Center, and I went on a date to attend that opening. It was with, you know, like a social event with a guy.
Is there anything more geeky than that?
Yeah.
Well, we geeks are nerds, but still nerds back then. But
yeah.
But people did flock to him, and he, as you say, he was able to tell people about what your industry was like.
Yeah. He reached the public in a way that the rest of us couldn't.
Back then, one of the big topics was, how is the computer going to affect productivity?
Computers are going to be tremendously productivity enhancing in terms of, again, communications.
Right.
Electronic mail, getting people in the know about what's going on in their companies. And I think the most interesting impact is that they're going to assist in the decentralization of business, and they make it possible for small businesses like mine to operate.
Mm-hmm. Esther has hit on, I think, the most important trend here that can only be reemphasized, and that's the trend toward the computer, or the personal computer especially, becoming a communication technology, much mm-hmm. more so than a computational one. What we have now, this personal computer on our desk, is a transitional technology. It's something that we've got that we're trying to figure out what we really intend to do with it. We're reaching the point now where in your brain, about 80% of your brain capacity goes into processing visual data. And that trend is being followed by the personal computer in the future. We're moving to processing visual and audio data, attaching little sound and video clips to our email documents. What we're doing is we're creating a kind of electronic tribal structure that can allow us to finally deal with the small groups of people at widely dispersed locations, just like we did when we were, in a tribe with 200 members.
That, of course, was computer columnist Robert X. Cringely, who, along with Esther Dyson, was on our show in 1992. Didn't really foresee the giant rise of the internet. How did that just sneak up on us?
I would argue he did see it. Electronic mail was not just local. It and again, I was using email to stay in touch with Russia. It was that decentralization, and that it didn't matter where you were. You had access to all those resources as a small business. You had a small piece of it, but the economies of scale that had helped those large businesses for so many years no longer were going to matter as much.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the big shift.
And that helped you.
Yeah,
your
it helped
business.
Me, and it helped. I mean, all the startups now, same thing. They outsource everything except the one thing that they do.
Mm-hmm. And of course, I guess I was referring to the World Wide Web, which.
That was later.
That was a game changer.
Yeah, because at that point it was just downloading text files from somewhere.
One of the big things that's changed in the use of computers as media devices.
What about the latest rush to multimedia? I mean, is this something that you welcome, Esther Dyson?
I think it's great stuff, but I think it's way oversold.
It's hyped too much, you think?
It's so easy to like. It's very easy for journalists to write about it. It's got more immediate appeal than text.
Now, this is where you can run movies on your PC at the same time as you're in the middle of a program. So if you wanted to know something, let's say, about Abraham Lincoln, you could click on that and a little film of Abraham Lincoln would come on or something.
Right. Like. And in theory, you can do all these great presentations to sell your new Wonder Widget broom sweeper.
Uh-huh.
But the problem is people are going to be creating an awful lot of junk, and there's not going to be anybody with the time to look at it.
Wow, that's all about multimedia today. You were giving me a big thumbs up when you were listening to that.
Yeah, well, that was the part about people will be creating too much junk and there'll be no one around to listen or watch it.
they didn't think of cats.
Yes.
But he also said that people will not have enough time, he thought, to look at it.
Right.
Which they do. They make the time now, don't you think?
They don't have enough time to look at all the stuff I produce. No, what I mean is jokingly, mm-hmm. Everybody's producing stuff, but most of it never gets seen by anyone other than their immediate family.
Yeah. I remember when we did a show back in 1993, a year after mm-hmm. this, because we wanted to continue the trend. And we did a show called What Is This Thing Called the Internet? And we had people on talking about the World Wide Web, which is almost impossible to visualize
if
someone tries to describe it to you. But the most interesting thing is we asked the public, what would you do if you had access, could do anything on the internet? And we got some phone calls coming in. And one guy said, you know, wouldn't it be great if you could, he used the phrase, I could download my CDs on the internet. In other words, I could send music. I could download
online.
My music
online.
And, of course, that is huge industry.
And Granny could share her photo album.
No, that's going to never happen. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Revisiting the old days with Esther Dyson. Okay, I'm going to ask you to get your crystal ball out. Esther, you hit so many home runs in this look 23 years ago. Would you dare look forward for the next two decades or so?
It depends what you ask about.
I'm going to ask you giving you an open book. You can comment on where you think computing, gadgetry, wherever, is going to be 23 years
from now. The biggest challenge is, in a sense, too much choice. And people will want to automate choosing. They'll want to have assistants that find the optimum for them. But this really is this fundamental global warming, global sickening, global optimization. You know, I'm not demonizing the internet, but it's people keep thinking, well, this can't really be the best, and I can keep looking for the best, whether it's the best mattress or the best husband or the best food. We've become so powerful, we stop being satisfied with where we are, and that's a social, mental issue. Technically, we will have, we'll have drones delivering stuff. We'll have almost every object will have an identity. It will be addressable. It will tell you about itself. The challenge is you won't want to know about most of the objects, just the way you don't want to know everybody you run into in the street, but it's going to be possible to.
Yeah.
So the biggest challenge is going to be filtering and selecting rather than finding.
Do you have a fear that some of the other technologists have about robots getting too smart and taking over?
No. It's much more complicated than that. I think what I have a fear about is humans not understanding and not valuing enough the human element, not paying for children's teachers for early childhood education, I have this joke cartoon in The New Yorker where you have the Four Seasons and it has a sign that says human room service. You know, only the elite will get human room service, but actually everyone should get human service. And it's not half the world serving the other half of the world, as that would be the dystopia. What's the utopia is 90% of the world serving 90% of the world. Some people serve on Tuesdays and other people serve on Wednesdays, but everybody has a job that has meaning and has human connection, and everybody has people in some form or other serving them. So you have an economy where the machines do all the hard physical labor, but the human labor of teaching and paying attention and things like that is still needed. Now, will we have the wisdom to get there? I don't know.
Well, we'll have you back. We'll meet back here 23 years from now.
Okay, it's a deal.
Okay. My guest has been Esther Dyson, a computing guru from another lifetime. We were talking about our show 23 years ago. Also on that show was Robert X. Cringely. Thank you, Esther, for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. It was great.
And if you want to know more about Esther, you can go to our website, The Way to Wellville. That's what she's involved in now. And the website is?
Hiccup. HICCUP.CO.
There you go.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, a classic interview from our vaults, a conversation with Carl Sagan and Ann Drian. It's a gem. You don't want to miss that. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For the rest of the hour, we're going back to October 9th, 1992, to revisit an interview with Carl Sagan and Ann Drian. They join me to talk about their book, Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, A Search for Who We Are. And in it, they explore the origins of our human nature, our prejudices, and why we fear and sometimes despise other cultures. And even though this conversation is almost 25 years old, you know, it's a conversation that seems to fit right in today and gives a little insight, scientific insight, about why we humans act the way we do.
One of our pet topics of discussion on Science Friday is origins. Where do we come from? Who our ancestral parents were? In that vein, we've enjoyed the company of guests such as Niles Eldridge, Jared Diamond, E.O. Wilson, Barbara Smuts. And this hour, we add two more. They are authors of a new book entitled Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, A Search for Who We Are, published by Random House. I think you might recognize their names. Let me introduce them. Dr. Carl Sagan is the David Duncan Professor of Astronomy and Space Sciences at Cornell University. He is also the director of the university's Laboratory for Planetary Studies. Dr. Sagan has played a leading role in the Mariner, Viking, and Voyager spacecraft expeditions to the planets. He wrote the book Cosmos, and along with his wife, Andrian, turned it into an Emmy Award-winning television series. Dr. Sagan joins us from member station KUSC. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ira.
With him in the studio is Andrian, the Secretary of the Federation of American Scientists. Ms. Drian was the creative director of NASA's Voyager Interstellar Record Project. You may remember that record that was put on the Voyager. And so she's responsible for sending rock and roll to the stars. And she has served as a writer-producer of PBS's Nova. Welcome to you, Ms. Drian.
Ira, it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, goodness. So early in the program. Well, thank you very, very much. It would be an understatement to say that you two have really taken a large ambition with this book, The Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors. It encompasses cosmology, evolutionary biology, anthropology. Give us a little background. What did you set out to do when you first started researching this book?
This book came out of frustration and sense of worry that Annie and I had in the early 1980s. Not just a world in which the United States and Soviet Union were at each other's throats with 60,000 nuclear weapons at the ready, but also spreading ethnic hostilities and incompetent leaders and declining educational standards and a sense that the world was getting to be too much for us humans, that some catastrophe might be around the corner. And we set out in part just for our own curiosity and concern to try to understand the origins of these circumstances. And maybe we thought we would go back, to the time of the origin of the United States and the former Soviet Union. But we found that the further back we went, we still didn't find a moment when these propensities came into circulation in the human species. We went back to early recorded history, but we were the same people then. We went back to the before the invention of agriculture and the domestication of animals, the beginning of civilization, but we were the same people then. And indeed, as far as we can tell, back to the earliest human beings on Earth. And that still wasn't the time that these propensities were came into us. We found that we had to get into deep time, into a time before humans had ever set foot on the Earth, to look at our primate and even earlier ancestors to understand how we got into this mess.
And these ancestors then are the shadows that you talk about in the title, Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors?
Well, exactly. They are the influences and the forces that we carry within us without any consciousness of their effect upon us. We do not say that their influence is our destiny. We feel that we have many capabilities to overcome, in some cases, those inheritances which do not serve us anymore. And in other instances, there are some very valuable traits, the traits of compassion, of ethics, of consciousness that we've inherited from them, and that we're not cognizant of our debt to them in that sense.
Just to amplify a little bit more, almost everywhere we look on the Earth, especially the dominant human societies, we can see ethnocentrism, our group, whichever it is terrific and wonderful, the apple of God's eye. Xenophobia, those other groups, they are disgusting, beneath contempt. They deserve hostility. Sexism, women should be kept in their place, and they have no right being uppity, and they should do whatever we men say. Dominance hierarchies, which especially fascinate men, the alpha male, we should show reverence and obedience to, but those lower down in the hierarchy from me, I can kick around all I want. That mix, which seems so prevalent, so human, it didn't have to be. You could very well imagine a species without those feelings and propensities. The question that we try to address is, how did those propensities get in us? What role do they serve? And how predetermining are they? And that, as we say, took us back well before the origin of the human species.
And you say many of these things then are hardwired into us. I mean,
hardwired, but not in the sense, Ira, of being predetermining. A way of looking at it is, we have a variety of different inclinations and propensities in us. The most, you know, superficial introspection shows that. We have warring tendencies. And society places a kind of stencil on this range of propensities. And where the little cutouts are in the in the stencils, some propensities are permitted to be expressed. Where there are no cutouts, other propensities are suppressed. Different society lays a different stencil down, different set of cutouts, different set of permissible propensities. And our job is not to wipe out propensities, but to arrange the stencils, to design societies so that the best in us is brought out, and those propensities that served their role 100,000 or a million years ago, but that are archaic and counterproductive now, do not take over.
You spend a lot of time in the book showing just how similar we are to our ancestors or other animals that are still around today. We've had other anthropologists coming on the program who've told us how closely we are related to chimpanzees. I think you pointed out in your book the same 1.6% difference in the genetic material between we and the chimpanzees. And you also point out that we have to look at maybe possible normal behavior in these other animals as maybe being normal behavior in ourselves too. Would that be fair?
That is fair. But of course, there are some differences between us and the chimpanzees. We are a little smarter. Our brains are a little larger. And so there's room for, I think, somewhat more ad-libbing. But yes, we would be foolish. Some figures say that we share as high as 99.6% of our active genes with chimpanzees. We are closer to chimpanzees than chimpanzees are to gorillas, than horses are to donkeys. And so while there's some traditional human repugnance at recognizing our similarities and what we have in common, it's the height of foolishness not to want to study them closely to get better insight into the why we do the things we do. And once you do begin to study them, everything, all human enterprises become so dramatically different, and you have a wholly different perspective on who we are. I found this very, very true in this recent political season, watching how some candidates are trying to push those ancient primate buttons to get us to be more concerned about team spirit, for instance, and patriotism than the challenges that we face. So unless we're aware of how those buttons work and the cynicism of those who push them, then we're just putty in their hands.
Mm-hmm. And there's a chapter in your book called What is Human? And there's an interesting, you throw out a sort of a rhetorical question that says, is there anything we do that's uniquely human, that all or almost all of us of every culture throughout history do and that no other animal does? You might think something along these lines would be easy to find, but the subject is redolent with self-deception. We have too much at stake in this answer to be unbiased. Do I take that to mean that you really could not find anything uniquely human that us as animals do that other animals don't do?
Yes, that's what we found. You know, every philosopher adjudged great in our tradition, going back to Plato and Aristotle, Kant, Rousseau, everyone in between, they all agreed on one thing. They said, man is the measure of all things. Man is the only species that has politics, religion, ethics, art. And these vaunted claims for superiority all fall in the face of scientific study. And so we're left with differences in degree rather than differences in kind. A close, dispassionate study of our fellow primates reveals them to be rich in many of the qualities that we're so proud of.
Give me an example of, for example, like religion. Do primates create gods and religions and idols and things like that?
Well, you have to ask, what are we talking about when we say religion? Mm-hmm. Certainly, the dominance hierarchy, which so transfixes chimp society, involves something very akin to worship of the alpha male, abasement before him, willingness to do anything to please him.
But you could say that about your boss also.
If only he will touch me, I will be reassured. And this is a degree of groveling and abasement that is even beyond what most religions today require of their adherents, although back in earlier times this kind of institutionalized submission was much more common, not just in religion but in mm-hmm. secular life before the absolute monarch. Mm-hmm. Religions certainly are more than abasement before a powerful being, but it's hard not to ask the question mm-hmm. about whether beings who are geared and pre-wired for such a dominance hierarchy, who moreover live in circumstances in which there's an enormous disparity in power, do not feel something akin to religious impulses. And in any case, it's very hard until we're able to interrogate chimpanzees to a much better degree than we are today to be sure that they don't have something like religion.
We're listening to an archival interview with Carl Sagan and Ann Drian, recorded on Science Friday in October of 1992. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International.
Your critics will, and some of them already have, said that you're in danger here of anthropomorphizing these animals.
Yeah, but there's a bigger danger of neglecting our close relationships. Mm-hmm. The fear of anthropomorphizing, that is, putting human characteristics on other animals who are in fact very different, there is such a danger. But the opposite danger of pretending that there is an unbridgeable gap between us and the other animals seems to us more serious. It plays into human vanity, our wish to be special, our wish to be different, our wish to be the apple of God's eye. And that kind of conceit and arrogance has caused us, not just in the global ecological catastrophe, but in many other areas, has caused us great mischief. And we have, in going through the pronouncements of the great philosophers and many, many other scientists on this issue, have been astonished how often, with absolute authority and assurance, we've been told that we humans are different, better, superior than the other animals, only to find that the data shows something just the opposite. Mm-hmm. Tool-using, tool-making, self-consciousness, propensity for language, the widest range of capabilities that we have imagined only we had, and you didn't have a smidgen of it in other animals. All that turns out to be wrong.
My guests this hour are Dr. Carl Sagan and Ann Drian. They're authors of a new book, Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, A Search for Who We Are. Let's go to the phones to Bob in California. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, howdy.
Howdy.
For a long, long time, there's been an argument, what's predetermined? What does society do to a person? How do you change that? But I was just interested in finding out what the author's views was. Okay, now what? What are we going to do with this information?
All right, let's ask him. Who wants to take a crack at now? What do we do with this knowledge?
Well, knowledge is power, and when we're let's say in the election right now, when we are appealed to, when the sort of those ancient components in ourselves are appealed to, in an effort to distract us from the real problems that we face, we can have one of many reactions. We can say yes, This is, we can look at Pat Buchanan, for instance, and when he's telling us that we should put women back in their place and we should hate homosexuals and we should be proud of our particular little troop and have disdain for the other troops, we can either say, way to go, Pat. This is something God-given and it's the way it's got to be. Or we can understand that this is a kind of attempt to manipulate us, mm-hmm. to divide us, to distract us from the real issues that we face. I think that what we've discovered in the course of researching and writing this book has really affected our way of thinking and has given us not only a sense that we now recognize the Pat Buchanan within ourselves and those impulses, but also that we come away with it with a much greater sense of hope that human beings have the capacity, as Carl's stencil analogy illustrates, to encourage some of these dispositions and to discourage others of them. Mm-hmm. And so when you say, so what? Well, you can say, you know, so what if we get a message from a distant civilization? There's a kind of so what component or response to any answer. But I think it's more likely that you're going to feel, wow, there's more life in the universe. There are other beings out there. It's possible for civilizations to survive their technological adolescence. And the same with what we've discovered, that it's possible to know ourselves, to see ourselves as a part of the fabric of nature, and to act with that knowledge, to act with wisdom and perspective.
It's about the last comment we have for today. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Carl Sagan and Anne Drian. They are authors of a new book entitled Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, A Search for Who We Are.
That was Carl Sagan and Anne Drian, recorded on Science Friday on October 9th, 1992. We're going to be revisiting more of these historic conversations throughout the year. It's our 25th anniversary year, and we're going to be bringing some of these old gems back to life. That's about all the time we have. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you like us on Facebook, and you can continue a week-long discussion on Twitter at SciFry. If you'd like to write us, yeah, please send your letters to Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. And you can email us, of course. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. Have a happy new year. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.